You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa. And had a little confusion there on getting the switchover from the Filmosophers music to the Writers' Voices music. But here we are on Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. And I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And my mother is not able to be here today. Her very dear friend and sweetheart of 10 years passed away this morning. So she didn't feel up to doing a live radio show today. Bob Stewart, who had visited with us here in the studio many times when he was here from North Carolina, where he lived, to Iowa. And they have such a lovely story. My mother and Bob were high school sweethearts, went their separate ways, and 50 years later, after both of them had lost spouses, they reconnected and have been sweethearts ever since. So say a prayer, and Bob was a wonderful man. But on a happier note, we have a return guest with us today, Michelle Gable with The Book of Summer. And this is Michelle's third novel. She's a New York Times best-selling author of A Paris Apartment and I'll See You in Paris. Michelle graduated from the College of William and Mary, and after a 20-year career in finance, she now writes full-time. She lives in California, and she's joining us by phone. Welcome back to Writer's Voices, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry about your mother, sweetheart.
Yeah, me too. So once again, you are back with, now this is like your third published novel in less than 4 years, right?
Yep. My first one came out in April 2014.
Okay. Wow. So that's just 3 years.
Yep.
Are you like that fast a writer?
I can write pretty quickly. The writing part is the easiest part, really. It's the research and piecing together all the different parts. All my novels are based on true stories or real people. So that tends to be what takes up the most time, just trying to button down the historical detail to make that as accurate as I possibly can.
Now, I love the kind of niche that you've created here, and you know, maybe there's other people doing similar things, but where you take a true story, and if I recall correctly, at least one of them came from a newspaper clipping, and another one maybe came out of the research you did for the first one, and you take that and you build a two-part story around it, one set at that historical time and another set in the future, but somehow related either by the characters being descendants of the original characters or some other connection with those original characters. And you go back and forth between the two stories, and they're romance stories in a way, but there's so much more to it than just the simple romance.
Yeah, hopefully that's how it comes across. I do love threading a real-life story or real-life people into fiction and building a world around that. So for The Book of Summer, it was about the homes on the easternmost side of Nantucket Island that are in danger of falling over the bluff due to erosion, and I kind of built a story around that. And I do like to keep both in, include a little romance. It's kind of, like real life.
Right.
Have a little romance. Hopefully have a little romance and drama and happiness.
Now, how did this idea, this fact of these houses being endangered, how did that come to your attention?
I read an article in Vanity Fair about it, and I immediately just pictured this house that's been in the family for 99 years. I knew immediately there'd be a guest book in it, one of those guest books for people write little tales of their story, and that's called The Book of Summer, and that's the title of the book. And I knew that would be a good way to also incorporate, weave together the different time periods and also include some other people's voices that maybe aren't characters per se, but they still get to have a little voice and a little, they get to say something in the narrative. And I love World War II novels, but they almost always are set place in Europe, and so I wanted to explore it from a stateside perspective. I and the women and people left behind as people go off to war.
Well, I was wondering how you came to the decision to set the historical part of the novel right at the beginning of World War II, because, of course, there could have been any number of different times that you could have selected. But I expect that particular time allows for a lot of drama.
Yes, exactly. And it's kind of that moment of you're kind of nervous, not knowing what to expect. You know, it's kind of, they always say, your imagination is sometimes worse than what actually happens, like your anticipation, what you're worrying about, what's coming. It's sort of that nervous anticipation that we're on the brink of war. Are we really going to join in? There's a lot of divisiveness in the family of my characters. You know, some think, you know, we should just mind our own business, and others think that's just, you know, isolationism is just not the way to look at the world. So it's an interesting time, and it's fraught with the nerves, but then patriotism and bravado and kind of just a whole mix of emotions.
We often forget, you know, we think of World War II as we were all in it together, and we forget how much how different people thought about getting into the war. And even probably once we were even in, it wasn't like everybody supported the war.
Oh, definitely not. Yeah, my character Ruby, who's a newlywed and in the late 30s, and she just thinks, you know, okay, here, my real life is starting, I'm married, everything's going to be great, and this is so silly. Why would we get in a war? We've already proven that this was a disaster last time we got into Europe war, you know, and she views it from kind of a very naive standpoint. Her brothers are telling her, look, you know, it's not, this is a world, we live in a world, we don't just live in the United States, we're all in this together. But it was very divisive, and there were lots of strong opinions on both sides.
Now, Michelle, did you spend much time on Nantucket to research?
I did. I went a couple times for a few different weeks. You know, I like to get a feel of the place, and it's a good excuse anyhow.
And did you find a specific house that you modeled this family home on?
Well, there was a house that did fall over the bluff called Bluff House, and I kind of modeled on that, but it was an amalgam of several houses plus a healthy dose, you know, of my imagination. The people that owned Bluff House are very different. They're, you know, in no way are my characters supposed to represent those folks. And I have an idea of kind of different houses. It's a lot bigger than most of the houses along Baxter Road, the one I made up. I just wanted a bit more of a compound. And my family actually, last summer, we stayed on Baxter Road, kind of on the street that my characters belong to. So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, so does that help you in, do you feel that to actually be in the environment you're writing about, to capture the flavor and the details?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, in this day and age, you can do it remotely. You don't have to go. You can, you know, interview people and look at articles and look at Google Earth, and you have a number of options. But for me, I do like to be there. You know, you talked about at one point when you're way up that high on Baxter Road, the wind and the sand is in your teeth and it's on your skin. And that's from like what I personally felt being there once. I was taking a walk up Baxter Road and I was like, it is so windy when you get to the lighthouse, and the sand was in my teeth and in my hair. And so I added that detail later after I'd walked it myself.
When you're writing these books, do you write the storyline of one timeline separately from the one from the other, from the modern timeline? Or do you go back and forth as you're writing, you know, in the published books, you go back and forth between the two timelines. But what is it like when you're writing?
Right, yeah. It's actually varied for all my books. For my first book, the historical part is pulled through a courtesan's diaries, and I would write big chunks of that at one time, maybe a quarter of the book. I didn't use all the diary entries, but I would do big chunks at a time. For my second book, it was similar to that, and then this one, I really did go more back and forth, almost in the way that you see it in the novel. But when I edit, I do several rounds where I just go through and read the historical part front to back several times and edit it that way, and then I do the modern day several times, and I do the whole thing. So I do, when I edit it, I definitely separate it out, but it kind of depends, and I'm not sure why I changed this time. I think it was a little easier for me to get in the voice of the historical characters, so a lot of times I wanted to, for example, the Partisan's Diaries, I wanted to spend more time in The Voice, so I didn't want to go back and forth so much. That's sort of sink into that particular voice in that particular moment for as long as possible.
Is it hard to keep the sort of the vocabulary consistent with the time period that you're in when you're going back and forth like that?
I try. I mean, I try hard to. You know, that's always going to be a challenge. I try to, you know, read magazines from that era, read books from that era, watch television shows, movies from that era. So I try to be consistent. And if there's a question, a lot of times I'll use a word and then I'll think, I don't know, that word's modern. I'll look it up and see, you know, when was it first used? Okay, so that word wasn't used until 1960. Okay, I can't use that word there. So I do try. My copy editor, that's kind of part of their job too.
You know, it's funny because sometimes words that you think are modern, when you look them up, you find they were used in the 20s or
30s. I know, isn't that funny? And it'll say something like, oh, first used in 1880, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, like I had no idea. Or even an expression, you know, an expression, you'll just think, okay, that feels like modern, but no.
And what's really cool is that we can just Google it to find out. I mean, 30 years ago, if you were writing this, how would you have even known if a word was available?
I know, I guess you would just have to find, like, books or, like, books of letter. You know, I'll read, like, letters from the time period, and maybe you just can't take as many risks then. You know, you have to say, okay, well, if there's any question, I better just not use it.
Right. Now, did you have a chance to talk to people who were alive during that time period?
Yeah, I talked to several. So I talked to some people that live on island now, but are older, so they, you know, remember, you know, the Coast Guard, you know, strolling the beaches and that sort of thing. Because that is the easternmost part of the United States, not just the island itself, but the United States.
Oh, wow, of course.
So they had the Coast Guard out there, and so I did talk to people who went through that and have those kind of memories, the memories of the blackout, you know, or the stars in the window and that kind of thing.
Now, there was also a lot of social activity, particularly before the start of the war. It kind of dwindled off, of course, after the war started, but there were, you know, parties and clubhouses and golfing and so forth. And how did you research that aspect?
I looked a lot at newspapers, the local newspaper, and I had to go look at that in person because it was on microfiche, but you know, it'll say, like, okay, well, all these restaurants are closing, they would say, for the duration, is what they called it, instead of for the season, for the duration of the war. Or they would say, okay, actually, they're only going to run one ferry per day, I mentioned that. Or, you know, now this club is going to stay open, but these clubs are going to close, or this restaurant is the only one that's open. That sort of thing, they announced that a lot in the papers, so I would use the papers to try to figure out, okay, well, would they have been able to do this? Because there's one point where they try to take a ferry, and you know the ferries are running a lot less.
And before the war started, when there was, like, it seemed like there were parties every weekend, was that accurate? Would that be in the paper, reports of those parties, and, you know, like costume parties and those kind of details?
Yeah. So the parties, like, they go to a party and it is a costume party. They dress like, you know, American figures, and that was from a paper that, you know, people really dress like that. It even talks about how the band dresses, and that's how the band dressed on that night for that particular party.
Oh, wow. So these parties you write about were really, really happened on those particular nights, some of them.
Yep. I try to do that as much as possible. Even though I write fiction, I try to make it at least plausible, where you can say, okay, well, that could have happened there, and so if there was a party, I wanted the party to be, like, a big party like that. Obviously, if it's a small little house, dinner party is different, but a big party at the yacht club, you know, that's exactly, I found all the details I could about that particular party, either from, you know, if I could find it in a book, or if I could find it in that one I found in some newspaper articles, people talking about, you know, here's what they did, and then talking about the fireworks show, and then they would drop the things from the planes, that happened.
Wow. Now, Ruby's father was a scientist who had invented some way of processing rubber, ended up making golf balls, and then switched to gas masks. Was that patterned after an actual real business?
Yep, it sure there was. And it was the Titleless Falls. That's exactly how. Now, this isn't, that family didn't have a house on Nantucket, that part. It's not the same guy. But when I found that interesting, I don't even know how I stumbled across. I think I was trying to find, like, a manufacturing-type business that was in New England. And I came across that, and I saw that they made the Titleist golf balls that, you know, people use today, the number one golf ball in the world today. But then they did switch to making gas masks during the war. So I thought that would be very interesting to use the novel.
Did you have to get permission to use that detail?
No, my my editor was a little concerned, and they went through legal to see what he had to do. Because you have the thing, the disclaimer at the front that says this is fiction, and when real things are used fictitiously. So I guess legal was fine with that. You know, I'm not trying to say that this is what happened with that family, and I'm also not trying to, like, sell golf balls or malign golf balls or anything like that, you know.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Michelle Gable, author of The Book of Summer. Michelle, would you like to read a little section from the book?
I don't have a copy of the book.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then we'll skip that part. So, now, is your publisher the same as for the previous books?
Yep. I was under contract for five books, so a book a year through 2019. So it has been the same publisher. I just signed a one-book deal for the first book and then two-book deals. So through my fifth book, it'll all be with St. Martin's Press.
Wow. So that's, you know, a wonderful start as a novelist. It seems pretty rare to get, you know, a multi-book contract kind of right out of the gate.
We signed a one-book contract for the first book, and they actually offered two books, but my agent was pretty adamant. She felt like the first book would do really well, so she wanted to do the, you know.
To renegotiate on the second, yeah.
Yeah. So then we signed a two-book deal, and then we signed a book deal for four and five, but it was all done pretty quickly, so it was nice to kind of have that, but, you know, consistency,
right.
And I, you know, it's great to have the same editor and the same publicist. That's very rare in the publishing world. There's a lot of turnover, people move around a lot, and so it's been great to have that sort of team. The marketing changes quite a bit, but my publicist and editor are the same, and it's very helpful, and we're all on the same page and have the same sort of views on things, and so it's a great team, you know, and a great working situation.
Well, and that might probably helps in turning the books, you know, getting them published pretty quickly because, you know, normally there's a pretty long lead time even between when you finish a book and when it hits the shelves. And to
I think people would be surprised. I don't know the publishing industry well. I think people are usually surprised. They think, you know, you turn in the book and then maybe 2 months later it comes out. And even with the Book of Summer, you know, I finished that book, and plus they have, as you know, the timing. You know, when do they want this book to come out? Is it a winter book? Is it a summer book? Obviously, the Book of Summer is a summer book.
Right.
I finished that book in September 2015, and so it came out in, May 2017, so over a year and a half later.
And that's pretty fast, actually. I mean, I've seen faster, but I've seen them take a lot longer, too. So have you written the next two already?
So I have written the next two, yep. I turned those in, and so I'm waiting to get some editorial notes on that one. I was a little late in turning in book four, but it was a big project with a lot of real-life people and real-life situations were involved. So.
And when will that one come out?
That one will, around this time, next year.
Right.
Yeah, and then same thing for the one after that.
So is it hard for you going, you know, if you're basically putting out a book a year, how long does it take you to research and write each one? Are you spending most of a year doing that?
Mm-hmm. I spend more time researching, I would say, than writing a first draft. Of course, once you read the book, it's nowhere near finished. So, you know, I can write pretty quickly in a few months, but of course it requires editing, it requires you know, lots of additional work on it. And the research I do leading up to it, I do a lot of research while I'm writing it. I do a ton more research after I turn in the book, and I'm waiting to hear back from my editor because I know we'll have another crack at the book. So right now, as my editor has books 4 and 5, I'm madly researching, looking at the things that I kind of piqued my interest for, but I didn't research in full because it wasn't, you know, part of the main story, but maybe it's an added detail. So I've been doing that while I wait and hear back. And I already have a long list of things I want to fold in when I get to the edit.
And are you also already thinking about book 6?
I'm always kind of thinking about it, or like things that pique my interest, or I'm noticing things. You know, I keep like a folder. I keep a private Pinterest board where I pin, you know, oh, this article is interesting, or this person's kind of interesting, or I'll even just take a picture of something I see and then pin it up there just as a reminder. So it's sort of an ongoing idea list. So it's not, you know, I'm not thinking of plot necessarily, but I do think of, you know, well, do I want to stay in the same region, or, you know, do I want to try something different? Do I want to do no historical or all historical, or, you know, mix it up, you know, kind of thinking about that, or thinking about which story that I've seen really is the one that makes me go, oh yeah, I want to live in that world. That's how I felt as soon as I thought of, you know, Foot House, The Book of Summer. I thought, yes, that's the one I want. That's my next story. That's the one I want to live in. So I'm kind of thinking about it, but more abstract from a, you know, further distance, I guess.
You do really delve into a world, don't you?
I try, yeah. I want it to feel real, and I want people to have questions and go Googling and research themselves and think like, oh, well, I didn't know about this erosion. Let me, you know, I don't know how I feel about this. Let me see what the two sides say. Or somebody, you know, Googles a certain person that was in my novel that was real. I love that. So I do try to create a whole world and the sights and the sounds and the feel of everything. I mean, that's why it was so fun to write about Nantucket. And Paris before is just...
Of course. Yeah, it's great to pick places that are fun to visit and you can deduct your travel expenses too.
Exactly. Yeah, it's quite a nice arrangement.
Now, when you're, you know, you get this idea, this concept for a setting, really, or for a situation, but then there's so much more to that, you know, in building a plot around it. What's your process like for that?
I usually have an idea of some main characters that I want, or I try to think of some problem that they might have, and I do outline my plot around, like, the real guideposts of, you know, this happened on this date and this happened on this date, and, you know, if they had a town meeting about this on this date, I try, you know, I build it around that, and I do outline, and I do have a sense of a couple characters, and I think about, you know, their personalities. I do, like, personality tests on them and see how those personalities would interact with each other. I have several, you know, processes I go through that, and then I outline it. But I do diverge from the outline as I'm writing. Things come up, people come up, things change, relationships change. For example, Ruby starts out and she doesn't really care for her sister-in-law, her brother's wife. She just thinks she's kind of a bore and thinks her brother settles. But over time, they develop, you know, not a close friendship, but a level of respect and love for each other that I had anticipated. They just kind of blossom. So I have enough outline where I'm never staring at a blank page, but then it's loose enough where, you know, I have room to think.
And do you know where the book is headed in terms of, you know, the plot from the beginning?
It's been a little different for all three of my books. For the first one, I actually, when the book that we sold, that we turned in, had a totally different ending of where the people, where April, the main character, where she ends up, in what country, who she ends up with. So we had that. And then, but Book of Summer, I knew the last line. I knew kind of what would happen, the characters. So I was driving to a certain with that book, and then I'll see
what
Terrace
was
something in between.
Is it harder to write if you don't know where you're going?
Yes, that's why I always have an outline. I mean, it's, for the ending, it's not, it can be a little hard, but I try to, you know, have have some sense or some idea. Maybe it changes. Like, I did know where I was going the first time around, but it ended up not being right for the story, so I later on. But, for me, I need to know where I'm going, because then it just keeps me motivated and keeps me moving forward instead of, staring at my stage.
So, Michelle, how much of yourself are in your characters? Are there any characters in the Book of Summer that you particularly identified with?
I don't really, but I did have someone ask me, which character is closest to me, and I said, I don't know. I said, I should ask my husband. He'd probably say Sissy.
So Sissy is the mother in the modern time who's a very strong go-getter character, not always entirely rational.
She is thinks that you can, if you have enough sheer will, you can get anything done, and she will do it, and she will bulldoze over you, and she will use her every last penny, her every last ounce of goodwill to get what she wants, even if it, as you said, flies in the face of rational behavior. So I would like to think I'm a toned-down version of Sissy. I am very determined, and very much a go-getter, but I would not go to the length that she goes to save the house. I would not.
And, of course, yes, Sissy's mission is to save her house in particular, which had been a family home, but, the house is on this bluff. And were there any characters or any real people that were kind of leading the charge to try and save those houses?
Yeah, absolutely. I talk about the preservation fund, and I changed the name a little bit because I didn't want those people to think I was trying to malign those anyway. it's the same fight as you see in the novel. The people that say, we can do this, we can build the walls, and we can do the sand, sand-filled baths, and we can move houses closer to the road. And then you have the other side that say, you don't mess with Mother Nature. Like you if you do one thing, it affects 5 to 10 other things. It's not
and you off-islanders shouldn't have built there anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You should know better than to have built on the bluff. People that have lived there their whole lives or their whole family's lives never built on that bluff. There is that fight and there is that debate. And I actually had one woman who lives on Nantucket email me to say that I got it exactly right.
Well, that's wonderful.
I tried to get it right, but of course I don't live there. I'm not living that reality. So I tried to see both sides of it, and I do see both sides of it, frankly.
And you have an interesting way of having your characters see both sides of it, too, and I'm not going to give that away. Michelle, we're out of time. We're out of time today, but I do want to tell you and tell our listeners how much I enjoyed the Book of Summer. I got into it right away, and I thought it was a really fun summer read. So it's a great book for summer, The Book of Summer by Michelle Gabel. And we look forward to you talking to you in a year when your next book comes out.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Now, this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we were just speaking with Michelle Gabel, author of The Book of Summer, and now take a short musical break and be back with our second guest. Back with Writer's Voices. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM. This is Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me now is Kimberly Braun, author of Love Calls, Insights of a Former Carmelite Nun. Kimberly will be speaking Saturday, July 8th, 2017 at Revelations Bookstore at 1:30 p.m. And she's here visiting Fairfield. So we're going to learn a little bit more about what brings Kimberly to Fairfield and about her journey as a former Carmelite nun. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Kimberly.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. I'm going to actually switch mics because I don't think that one's going to do it for me here.
Okay.
Here. There you go. Okay, that's better.
I'll say thank you again.
All right.
Great to be here.
Yeah. I have a little trouble sometimes with that particular one.
It's nice to be heard.
Isn't it, though? Now, you spent many years mostly in silence, however, did you not?
I did, yes. As a Carmelite, we lived in silence, so we didn't take a vow of silence, but the rhythm of our day was couched in silence, and we spoke infrequently.
Now, this book is the first of three. Is
that's
that true?
That's correct.
And are they
yes.
all done? Or
they are complete. I haven't published the other two. They're in queue.
Okay.
And I'm just waiting a little bit longer. And the other two are going to be much heartier. This is a very light read, kind of an entry point into a relationship around how we get to know ourselves in silence.
And so this covers a period of time mainly from college through 10 years as a, well, not even
just
10 years, just the first
four
year.
And a half.
4.5 years
right.
as a nun. Yeah.
Right, 6 more to go.
And so, of course, the question is, why did you leave? Because you write about it, you seem to love the experience.
I did love the experience. I'm really fortunate in that I was experiencing an inner love affair. In my language, spirit was so awakening within me at the center of my being. So my life had already become incredibly contemplative. I was living virtually in community in Santa Cruz, California, and we were all having heightened experiences, taking us into really deep places. So my joining the monastery was just wanting to be with the beloved. It was that simple. And I never looked back. This book ends after taking solemn vows, which is a vow you take and you stay in that monastery usually for life, or at least within the order. And I never looked back. But as we grow and change, my inner landscape changed as I opened more and more to the experience of love within me. And in that came a new direction coming from the same place of inspiration. So that illumination to leave came about 9 months before I actually did leave.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I felt that it was though very much the same reason I entered. So whereas it was a dramatic change outwardly, it was just staying the course inwardly.
Interesting. Now, did your superiors in the order look at it that way?
They didn't look at it that way at all for a couple reasons. First, I'm a young nun and they love new vocations
yeah.
and all of that. Second, I fit. You know, I am a contemplative by nature. And so it was like being a fish in water. So in their mind, I was meant to stay. But thirdly, and probably most strongly, the theology with taking solemn vows, it's a serious move to leave. And there was a feeling that I was losing my way.
Mm.
So there was, and I understood that. And it was coming from hearts that were truly grieving the thought that I was leaving.
Yeah. And I will say, reading through this, there isn't any sense of that you're criticizing the Carmelites in any way.
Thank you. Right,
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm 100% about making our life choices from a place that it's between us and our greater selves. And I made the choice very freely in entering. So everywhere we go, there's strengths and weaknesses, and we're all human beings.
Right.
So, but ultimately...
Isn't that the truth?
Right, right. And we all know what that means.
Yes, yeah. None of us are quite perfect yet.
That's right, yet, right? Even using that word is evidence. So no, I don't have any criticism. It remains a very deeply enriching time of my life and comes into everything I do.
Mm. Now, I got a little bit confused sometimes on the chronology the chronology of things. But I know that you were at Steubenville, which is Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. My three nephews have attended. Two of them graduated from there, and one is there now. And the oldest one is now, well, he's home for the summer, or he's in Iowa for the summer, but he's in seminary in Rome after having graduated from the priestly discernment program at Steubenville.
Wow, powerful, a powerful university.
Yeah.
For sure. And I was there back in the late 80s, and I actually only attended a semester. So when a lot of things were exploding for me interiorly, I was in California. And I started dating a man who had graduated from Steubenville.
Ah.
And having grown up in a family that was very big into the charismatic gifts of spirit, when I heard about Steubenville, I longed to go. So when I first did gain acceptance there, my thought was to take it all the way through. But again, my life was transcending, and transcending is not a good word. It was expanding. Yeah, it was expanding at such a rate that it seemed silly. And I had a great spiritual director who could see the movement and how authentic it was within me. It's like, well, you don't need a degree to be a Carmelite. Mm. And it was so clear that I was being called to that.
And yet the first monastery that you applied to that you were accepted, but then...
Wasn't that
strange? They changed
strange?
Their minds, yeah.
Right, that's right in the intro. I think that was a setup for me to have that inspiring moment in liturgy. I was really devastated because I had put all my eggs in that basket. And when they had said yes, I was simply entering for what would be a time of trial anyway. So from my mind, it was a yes all the way along. To hear that they were really thinking. And I think what they were doing is they were getting a lot of women who were having wonderful experiences at Steubenville. And the monasteries that were not far away, there were Franciscan, there were Carmelite, Dominican. Lots of us women were flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine, I never asked them, that from their standpoint, they were probably beginning to think, maybe everybody needs to get their degree. Instead of it being personal to me, more of like a unilateral, let's just take a step back because all these women are wanting to enter and are so on fire with love. And
yeah. Are there young women today still entering the monasteries, the convents?
Less and less.
Yeah.
Less and less. And since I've left, I haven't kept as close a tabs. But I think with how diverse opportunities are for men and women to live in community, to explore the contemplative aspects of themselves. There are options that are more flexible to the education of the people that are out there today. A lot of the monasteries, and I wouldn't want to make an overgeneralization, but because many are older, aren't as able to be as current and relevant.
Oh, yes.
Because the life is very secluded. And so I know even when I entered, there wasn't a big openness to computers coming on the scene and all sorts of other things. So I think that's probably to the detriment.
Now, Kimberly, why did you decide to write Love Calls?
I had a feeling all along that I would end up writing something that was semi-memoir based. I've been working with thousands of people over these years, and most of the time, it's the story upon the story. So I come into contact and I'm presencing someone's story and celebrating where spirit is there, where source is there. And a lot of times when people can relate to your own story, it lets them touch deeper places within themselves. I didn't think it'd be my first book out. I think I'll have many books I love to write. Mm-hmm. And I thought I would be writing something just more abstracting from all of my work and less intimate in the details. But I built a monastery in Texas in the latter part of being a Carmelite. And that was such a dramatic story. I realized I needed to get that written down or I was going to forget the miracles that happened Yes, it ends before you get there.
Yes.
I'm walking out the door to Texas in this book. And everyone that's read the book is like, ah.
I also realized I forgot to really introduce you.
Oh, right.
You know, Kimberly's, so a little bit about Kimberly. Her contemplative leanings began around the age of 5. She spent 10 years as a Carmelite nun living in monastery. Her master's in theology was completed in 2001 and is concentrated upon the adult spiritual journey. She enjoys officiating ritual, offering playful, inspiring keynotes, writing articles and books, and leading retreats. Her TEDx talk gives a taste of what it means to live a yes, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about what that means, and is the inspiration for books 2 and 3 in this trilogy. And you are meditation faculty at Omega Institute. And her website is KimberlyBraun.com. That's KimberlyBraun.com. What is living
your yes?
Yes. Living your yes.
Right. I know it's, and for some people that's a little tricky since we're working on setting boundaries nowadays and not giving too many yeses.
Yeah.
My explanation of that concept is that at our very center, at the soul center, is spirit, is source. And we live most fully when we say yes to that impulse or that inspiration within. So the yes is a continual response to what's already arising within us. And that allows everything in our lives to come into alignment. So wherever we may have resistance, confusion, dissolution, and the full range of challenges that we as human beings all have, the more we move into our yes, the more we come from a place and relationship to these challenges that dissolves that and creates a life-giving quality of presence.
How do you discern when something is coming from that point and not external, you know, where the motivation for something is?
That is such a great question. That's, I would tease out more questions. I would see it more on an individual basis, so that there is a way of moving through the layers to discern and discover. And some of the obvious simple ones are the sense of rightness and easefulness. I think life is meant to have ease, even when we have great challenges. But it's very challenging, I know, to discern when we're coming from that place. This is a funny story. I came into direct contact with how impure my motives of charity were my first 2 years in the monastery, because I feel my call is to be love. So that's at the core. And I think that's true and authentic and honest. In that process of being and becoming love, I have found in some very funny ways, how impure all my motives around being loving and charitable were. How I was looking to please, how I was looking for connection, how I was looking to be affirmed. And there was a short time when I became debilitated with even being charitable, because I felt like I was perhaps doing something worse than something better because my motives were so impure.
You know, that just sparked in me a memory of my father telling me. Now, my father died when many, many years ago when I was 21, so in 1981. So this was before that. And he had some kind of unusual spiritual concepts and ideas throughout his life. He evolved, you know. He never was part of a traditional religion, but I remember him saying something about that you really shouldn't give charity because it really wasn't for the other person's benefit. It was for yourself. So it was actually a selfish thing to do. And, you know, I think that's part of the answer. I don't think that's the complete story,
right.
But it is true that when you that when we give, we are benefiting ourselves, and not necessarily from a impure way either.
Right.
You know?
I came to that, but I needed to go through that little darkness.
Yeah.
So that I could actually learn that as a human being, our deep longings for connection, for belonging, for a sense of purpose, that these are prevailing desires that exist within all of us. And all the ways that we answer to it, even my realizing that, oh, when I run to get this stool for this sister, even though I'm partly doing it because I love her and partly doing it because it's the good girl thing to do, that I shouldn't not do it.
Right, right.
That I'm participating in being human by recognizing and being vulnerable enough to say, well, I'm actually hoping to receive as well.
Well, and also think, this is kind of taking it another step, that the person who needs help or needs charity, and I'm thinking of this more in, you know, sort of a societal level, is actually doing a service by giving me the opportunity to help them.
Right. I think it's in Deepak Chopra's Seven Spiritual Laws of Success and the Law of Giving. He speaks to the reality that giving and receiving are two sides of the same coin, that the universe is in dynamic exchange.
Yes.
And when we're participating, no matter what end of the exchange we're on or what capacity we're within, that's all part of the law of giving. And I would even take that further to say, because the divine is coming into form and celebrating itself, when we celebrate by being in connection that way, it's actually even the ineffable celebrating itself within us.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Kimberly Braun, author of Love Calls, Insights of a Former Carmelite Nun. She will be speaking at Revelations Bookstore Saturday, July 8th at 1:30 p.m. Kimberly, would you like to read for a few minutes from the book?
Of course.
Yeah, let's do that.
I thought to read a poem.
Okay.
And then depending on your time, I could read a short little vignette.
All right.
And you can stop me anywhere. And if there's a part you liked, I'd be happy to read that too.
I like the potatoes.
The potatoes are great. If you can find that page, I'll read the potatoes.
Okay.
And maybe I'll start with this poem. And,
okay.
Lip to lip, we suck the moment, tender, raw, free. A word plunges me into you. A phrase opens the dark door of discovery, and your light shows up softly, striding forward to take me. My shoes and dress fall off as my lips reach yours. Without touching you, I touch you, quivering. Without hearing your voice, I vibrate in its sound. Without and within, I go, twisting and undulating in the rhythm of your love.
So 114.
Oh, page perfect. 114. I know, that's such a great story, isn't it? Okay. Want me to start at One Popular Way?
Yes.
Yeah. One popular way, we ate a lot of potatoes. We lived off the land in North Dakota. I'll preface that. Was pan-fried chopped potatoes. Sister Elijah mastered these years back, and now it was my turn. Mother Anna was specific in how they were prepared. Cutting them into half-inch naked white cubes was easy. Heating the oil and adding the potatoes was, of course, a piece of cake. The stress came when they needed to be turned. The first time, I must have begun to turn the potatoes too soon. They were partially raw, but I thought they would cook through. 6 cups of potatoes needed to be fried in our skillet. Some of them did not even touch the oil. At the same time I was tending them, beets needed dehusking, carrots needed shredding, and custard needed to get into the oven. The potatoes were looking pretty bad, with some sides burning, others raw, and some not getting to meet the oil at all. Sweat formed all over my body as I flipped them, hoping for a miracle. They were turning into a disaster, which meant the community was going to have to suffer for it. Sometimes the meals we provided were the major consolation they had after long fasts and many hours of hard work. With the time for prayer upon us, the potatoes went into the warm oven with the hope they would be edible in 25 minutes. This would take the raw parts cooking and the burnt parts softening. I was asking for a miracle. Sext, that's a time of prayer, was a rigorous practice of turning my attention back to the present moment as it snapped like a rubber band to thoughts about the potatoes. Soon enough, we were in the refectory for our meal. The serving sisters whisked the warming towels off the food, revealing my potatoes, half burnt, half raw. Since the youngest dished up last, it was impossible for me to sift through the worst ones for myself. After the meal and before the dishes, I was called into Mother Anna's office. I knew it, inwardly getting ready to hear what I dreaded to hear. Sister Annunciata, those potatoes! And I dropped to my knees and kissed the floor. She focused very little upon the mistake after that, telling me to get up. Immediately she began advising me on how to make them better. When you are making the potatoes, she began, first you leave them in the frying pan until the bottoms have just become golden brown. Do not flip or touch them until that point. Usually about 10 minutes. Her confident voice paused only briefly. Easy enough, I thought. This was not what I had done, but it made sense. After they brown on the bottom side, drop everything else you are doing and focus only on the potatoes, she went on. A huge but silently arose from my belly, stifled before it reached my mouth. Start flipping the potatoes in a slow, continuous motion, her long fingers slightly bent through arthritis, yet elegant even in their age, modeled the motion. Keep flipping and do not do anything else until they are golden, and then quickly remove them. My mind zoned at this point as it burst into loads of defensive arguments. How can you tell me to drop everything else and also expect us to produce a meal for over 20 sisters? Have you ever worked in a kitchen like ours? Her instruction felt insensitive to how hard I try and how little time we have. Do you want me to go on, or is that probably time?
No, that's good.
I could paraphrase the rest.
Yeah. Why don't you do that?
It is such a funny story because that was 8 months into my time in North Dakota. I was still going to be there about 3.5 more years. And every time the menu came back and those potatoes were on the menu, she would put my name in red ink next to them. And because we lived in silence, even when I began producing them perfectly golden brown, I began to reel when I would see my name put beside the potatoes. My mind would go into all sorts of insecurities. Didn't she understand? Did I not do them well? Why can't this stop? I had discouragement and sadness and anger. Mm. And eventually the potatoes taught me a level of letting go that kept me in a place of equanimity to where I couldn't have cared less whether my name was put there or not.
And you also learned to make perfect potatoes.
So perfect. They were so perfect that she wrote me about them when I went to Texas. And I cried because all this time I thought she was, I took it as a punishing thing.
As a criticism, as a punishment. And do you think, and maybe she was putting your name there because she liked the way you made them and she wanted to have them, have you make them so they'd be good?
It was totally my own projection.
Wow.
Yes.
Now, you also learned, like, as you were, you know, improving, you learned certain lessons from it, or you absorb certain things from it. Do you think that she had any idea that
she was being an instrument to my inner growth?
Yeah.
I think in a broad way, because our life was so focused only on spiritual growth, that she had confidence that her role as superior was an opportunity to experience grace. So yes, I think in that way, whether she had an intuitive sense that what she was doing was hitting me on all those levels, I don't know about that.
I mean, she was pushing your buttons, for sure.
She was really pushing my buttons. And she was the spiritual director, too. And I would think that she usually heard disgruntlements from nuns. Now, I really went in wanting to experience the divine in everything. So I didn't have complaints. Whenever I note my complaints in here, it's because I'm noting my weakness, not because I think there's any validity to the complaint.
Mm.
And so that was my approach. So I never really went and, you know, vented or got things off my chest. I really let it be a learning. And I think she had a sense of that level of commitment to myself.
Mm.
I know, funny. It was really funny. Yeah.
Do you still cook potatoes?
I love to cook. I learned so much about cooking living off the land.
Oh.
So yes, I do cook potatoes.
Now, Kimberly, where do you live now?
I live in Boulder, Colorado.
And what brought you to Fairfield? We only have like a minute or so for you to answer, but...
Twofold. I'm helping out Michael Morgan, who's an amazing cranial sacral therapist here in town, and he's helping prevent Alzheimer's. I'm helping him with what he's doing, his mission. And I came in to speak at Revelations because I'm on the road for 8 weeks. I'm speaking at churches and festivals all around the country.
And how's that been going so far?
I love it. Getting to connect heart to heart with people, getting to hear their stories. It's such a blessing. It's humbling.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And do you know much about the TM movement and transcendental meditation?
I would say peripherally.
The reason I'm curious about or wondering about that is because the TM movement has something that's sort of equivalent to this with women living in community. It's a temporary vow. It's not a permanent thing. It's called Mother Divine. But I think that probably they have very similar experiences to what you write about in here.
I would imagine. And I just had lunch with two women who have been part of that.
Oh.
So I am learning quick while I'm here, getting an immersion.
Well, Kimberly, thanks so much for being with us today. If you're listening on Friday, please go meet Kimberly at Revelations Saturday at 1:30. If you're listening to our Monday broadcast, you've missed it, but you can get the book at Revelations.
Absolutely.
Love Calls, Insights of a Former Carmelite Nun. And now stay tuned for Planet Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.